Mr. Speaker.
You're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hingson.
Well, thank you for setting your podcast out of 14th and G. I am your host, Dean Hingson, coming to you from the worldwide headquarters of Melman Consulting, high atop the historic Colorado building in downtown Washington, D.C., joined once again by these guys, Republican Bruce Melman and Democrat David Thomas. We're going to cover 2023 in 23 minutes. Bruce, David, welcome to 14th and G.
Happy Easter, Dean.
Thank you, Dean. It's good to be here today.
Well, and a happy Passover to you, Bruce.
To be fair.
I know a congressman who'd like to attend that next year.
Well, boys, where to begin? At last check, Congress is in the second week of the Easter break, slated to return next week. Plenty has happened in Congress's absence.
Last week was a hell of a year.
Hell of a year, including of course, what's dominating the news. Asa Hutchinson, former Arkansas governor, is running for president.
Huge.
Anything else?
I think it's going to go about as well as the Mike Huckabee campaign.
Maybe don't start by announcing to Jonathan Carl on someone else's show, but that's just me. No, of course. Why don't we just take a look at a couple of the big tentpole issues Congress is going to deal with when they come back before we do get to what's dominating the news and late night television. We've got government funding. We've got NDAA. I think the debt limit, it's maybe not going to be a live fire exercise in the April May work period, but boy, they're sure going to be lining up the chessboard. Because we're getting close to when Treasury will exhaust extraordinary measures, and we get close to hitting that debt limit sometime this summer. So if there's a deal to be had, they're going to have to work it out. Speaker McCarthy seems to be trying to get the White House's attention on this. He says, "Hey, I'm here at the table. Why aren't you at the table, Mr. President?"
He's not at the table because he has not brought his homework with him. And I think that's what where we're at sort of loggerheads here is that the White House wants to see McCarthy's plan before they negotiate. And McCarthy wants to sit down and negotiate before he presents his plan. So we seem to have a chicken and egg situation with the White House here. I agree with you that I don't think we're going to see an immediate resolution to the debt limit issue, which is going to get scary as we get into May and closer to the summertime. The Treasury Department has said June without specifying a date for the debt ceiling being hit. A lot of posturing, a lot of going back and forth. I think at the end of the day that Senator McConnell, who is recovered from his fall earlier this year, is going to get involved in these negotiations because he and the president have done this before, and I think he's going to be a critical player at the end of the day.
Bruce, the new Republican majority in the House, they've
speaking of ish.
Right. I mean, they've picked some low-hanging fruit. They've established the China Committee. They've passed some right to life measures. This is where the rubber meets the road of this bare thin 5-seat majority when we get into issues like the debt limit. And Speaker McCarthy is having not unexpected, but he's having issues, keeping this caucus together.
Well, look, I'm not sure if it's rubber meets the road or trash can meets the dumpster fire, but that's a hard issue. Like, you could almost anybody you put into the role of the Republican conference right now of trying to bring together folks, I think, that are united in wanting to see some kind of fiscal discipline. I mean, the federal debt is up by a third in the last 6 years. Some of which was under Trump, a lot of which was COVID, some of which was additional $1.9 trillion beyond COVID measures for COVID put forward by the Biden administration. But we kind of have a debt problem as a nation, and there is no plan. Now, the problem is, as DT points out, it's not like there is a Republican unified plan. And no matter what plan you come forward with within the GOP, you will have your factions disagreeing with one another on you know, whether it's adequate or whether it's not adequate. So I'm not quite sure who on the Republican side, I know DT's answer is Nancy Pelosi, but on the Republican side, I'm not sure who could play these cards, which are really hard cards to play anymore. Sadly, every time I war game it in my head, I end up thinking back to when TARP failed before it passed,
right,
where the market vomits a few thousand points, and that is the stimulus needed for Congress to decide, yeah, we don't need to have a self-induced depression.
The market would have to vomit several thousand points to be, I think the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 800 points or thereabouts in 2008 when the TARP vote failed. And that was enough to, that was many orders of magnitude less than what the market's valued at today.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can tell you one person that the speaker doesn't have confidence in to get this done is his own budget committee chairman, Congressman Arrington, who he threw under the bus last week in the New York Times, saying that he has no confidence in his ability to get a deal and he's not involved. Even the easy things have been tough for Speaker McCarthy to start off the year here. The House has basically done almost nothing. They got a symbolic energy bill done that won't go anywhere in the Senate. They got the China bill done, which is the one place where there does seem to be some bipartisan agreement. I can't think of anything else, Bruce, that they've got done here. And again, this is, I think back to when Newt Gingrich took over the House. He had his 100-day plan, and they passed the Contract for America. They got every one of those things done
after
in the 40 first
years
days.
Of Democratic rule. It kind of
when
built
Speaker
up some
Pelosi
ideas.
Took over the House, she got her entire 6 Row 6 done in 100 hours. If you'll remember, we're 3 months into the year, and the Speaker can't seem to get anything done. I think his days are numbered.
Although remember, Newt had a Republican Senate, Speaker Pelosi had a Democratic Senate. There's a lot different set of chess pieces and positions on the board if you control both chambers in Congress. When you don't, McCarthy is moving forward with the things that can unify the conference first and foremost, such as the China Committee, which, by the way, is pretty significant.
I don't know. There's a lot more to do than just set up one committee in Congress here and a lot of things that have to get done. I'm very concerned about the House's ability to move the debt ceiling or anything else for that.
The NDAA is moving apace. The budget guys are being budget guys like they are. I mean, the big problem, of course, is when you go downstream from debt ceiling, you're not going to not extend the debt ceiling, which means you need to do something that's budget related. And that, as we've seen for 20, 30 years, is very hard because many elected officials believe, as then Senator Obama did, just simply ratifying it's a failure of leadership.
Well, it always is refreshing to have Republicans regain their belief in fiscal responsibility when Democrats are in the White House.
Well, and Democrats are in the White House, but for how long is an open question.
Asa.
We've got some movement on the Republican side. Got a few declared candidates. Former Governor Asa Hutchinson announced, former UN ambassador, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, and of course, former President of the United States Donald John Trump, who's now embroiled in a criminal case in New York City. He was indicted. He was indicted last week on over 30 counts of falsifying business records, raised to a felony by we don't know what. Another additional crime here. It seems not that there's not a lot of there swirling around the former president on a lot of things. With regard to the elections, with regard to January 6th, with regard to the records and materials he took with him from the White House. But this seems like thin gruel by the Manhattan DA.
I don't know why you're looking at me. It's bad enough they made poor Mitt Romney defend Trump in this silliest. Look, the broader thing that I worry about is, first, this makes people that much more upset about politics. You know, a lot of the older folks will remember when Bill Clinton was lying under oath in court, which is a crime about sex. The idea was, well, it's a personal sexual relationship, so the kind of traditional perjury, whatever, shouldn't apply. You now have Republicans who did not, you know, who did think it should the law should apply back then, somehow thinking the law shouldn't apply right now. To me, if anything, what shocks me is that there wasn't better command and coordination by the Democrats. Because of all the cases that could be brought against Trump, this is the weakest of the potential field. Maybe the Manhattan DA tried to move fastest to move first because he knew in Georgia and others there's more smoke and potential fire.
Well, look, I mean, I don't know if this one is the weakest or not, but I will tell you this. There's going to be more, whether, Dean, you correctly point out, whether it is in Georgia, whether it is here in D.C. There is so much illegality swirling around this guy, and I don't know if the chickens have come home to roost or not. But here's what I do know. For the past week, the only person anybody's ever talked about in the political sphere here in Washington, D.C. is Donald Trump. Nobody's talking about Nikki Haley. Nobody's talking about Asen Hutchinson. And most importantly, nobody is talking about Ron DeSantis. Donald Trump is going to be the nominee of the party, maybe even if he is in prison. He was right when he said it 7-8 years ago now. He could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't make a difference. He is going to run away with this nomination here. And I'm like at a loss for words that his illegality seems to make him even more popular with the Republican base.
David, forgive me if I hear a little bit of hopefulness in your tone. Democrats have played a dangerous game in congressional primaries, in Senate primaries. It has worked out for you electorally, getting the most radical Republican candidate nominated. Is there a little bit of hopefulness here amongst Democrats that you do get to run against Donald Trump again?
No, absolutely not. Nobody, I wouldn't want to risk the outcome of him being president again, because I don't think our country could take it. We've got a pretty resilient system that was able to piece it together for 4 years. I'm not sure we could take another four. I think the most important thing that that Democrats and Republicans should keep in mind is that since I've been allowed to vote, which the first election I was allowed to vote in was 1992, Republicans have won the popular vote exactly once. And I am 52 years old.
Damn.
That is a big problem for the Republicans here, that they are a dwindling party that is running to the fringe. And if they nominate Donald Trump again, my hope here is where the country would end up is with the Democrats holding the White House and Republicans really having to look back at themselves to see where they've ended
now,
up.
You do know that Republican candidates got 2% more votes nationwide for the House, where the whole country was voting, than Democratic candidates, right?
All I know is the only president who has won the popular vote since I've been allowed to vote is George W. Bush in 2004, Bruce. That's the only one. Every other one has been Democrats. That is a wave you're not going to be able to stop.
Unfortunately for my good friend David, we do not elect presidents by the popular vote. We elect them by the Electoral College. And President Trump did win that election in 2016. He spent the next 4 years, one of the biggest legacies of his administration is populating the federal courts. And we were all reminded of that this week when a federal judge,
Texas,
struck down.
When in doubt, Texas.
When in doubt, it's in Texas.
Fifth Circuit.
Struck down FDA approval of mifepristone, the morning after pill, the abortion pill. Struck it down, and now abortion. Add to that the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court election in Wisconsin, which seemed to really revolve around pro-life issues, and abortion politics is really top of mind here.
Well, and look, it's for Dems perversely in a lot of ways a gift that keeps on giving politically. It's one of the things that motivated the Dem base. It's one of the reasons the Dems held the Senate in 2022. You know, Republicans lose votes in places like Kansas. It's a 60-40 issue. And if you say not only you want to be on the 40% side, but you want to go to the extremes of that, just like when Dems go to unlimited abortion for any reason at any point in a pregnancy, they end up losing. When Republicans go to, you know, no exceptions that you're allowed to get an abortion, they lose. And this is one that people are mistaken if they think isn't going to have a huge impact in 2024. Republicans need to come up with what a position or what a story is that doesn't seem extreme to independent voters and to women in suburbs, or Joe Biden will be 500 years old and he's finishing his second term.
Look, there are two things that came to mind for me on this case when it came out here. One is the great irony of the fact of the number of questions I'd heard from senators on the Judiciary Committee over the years asking prospective judges, will you legislate from the bench? I cannot think of another example that would fall into legislating the bench than outlawing a drug that has been approved by the FDA for over 20 years. This is an ideological guy who's, you know, really doesn't appear to be following the law anymore, but just doing what he believes because that is his political position. Unfortunate. The second thing I thought was notable was those same senators on the Judiciary Committee, Republicans both in the House and the Senate, have been very quiet since this ruling came out last Friday. Republicans nationwide do not want to talk about this. And yet, this is the outcome of the Roe v. Wade decision. They're going to have to talk to about it more and more because of these cases that are coming up in state houses across the country or in the federal courts here, where the fallout of the Roe v. Wade decision is going to haunt Republicans for years and years to come. It is energizing the Democratic base in ways that we certainly haven't seen. I would be very concerned if I were a Republican, you know, candidate, House member, senator in a state that had any of these issues up in 2024.
Well, what's interesting about it too is you're seeing Democratic operatives trying to get abortion referenda on ballots, which is smart of them to do. You know, in the same way when they would back the more extreme Republican candidate, the theory being put them on the ballot, we're guaranteed to win. They recognize you put an abortion question on the ballot, you will get turnout that's very pro-democratic. It's shrewd, and unlike backing the extremist candidates, it's not. It doesn't seem playing with fire in the same way. So unless ours can come up with a better strategy, this is a headwind in 2024.
It's a headwind. It's a headwind nationally, but at some point, and DT makes a good point here. I mean, Republicans spent the better part of the last 50 years arguing for this issue to be returned to the states, and these constant efforts to refederalize the abortion question, wherever you come down on it, it seems to be the most disastrous course for Republicans. But no man is an island, and nor is the United States of America. We live in a world with some very interesting things happening. The Chinese Navy just completed weeks-long naval exercises in the straits around Taiwan. A lot of saber rattling there. The Chinese seem to have cut a deal with the Saudis to buy a bunch of oil, denominated in yuan, not in dollars. Another attempt, I guess, to subvert the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. The war in Ukraine continues apace. Bruce, what's the most? Congress seems most consumed by China. We've got the China Committee. So many issues surrounding, what is and is not acceptable for American businesses, particularly doing business in China, continues to be a big focus, right?
Absolutely. It's also the most bipartisan issue. You know, it's one where you regularly see R's and D's working together, collaborating. You know, sure. At the presidential level, everybody wants to be more of a hawk than the other side. But here we're seeing cooperation. The United States sees it as a need for a three-pronged strategy. We've got to run faster. So it's things such as the chips or infrastructure investments, though, you know, there's growing concern, including by the Bloomberg editorial pages. We're adding so many red tape requirements to the CHIPS Act that we're not going to accomplish the core goal of chips, because we're also worried about so many social policies that go with it. But run faster. Number two, slow down the other side. That's export controls. That's outbound investment restrictions. And number three, put the geopolitical band back together. Put your allies, have your friends, you know, whether it's trade deals or things like the AUKUS national security deal. The Chinese contrast with that at the same time, or first, they're trying to, with the Saudis, with the Iranians, with the Russians, with the Latin America and all the countries there, with Africa, they're trying to build their own geopolitical caucus, number one. Number two, they're trying to run faster and become more sanction-proof and self-sufficient, particularly in areas such as semiconductors. And finally, they're going to continue to throw matches at the pools of gasoline on our domestic discourse, because anything they can do to keep us divided and angry, which does not take a lot of work,
it's not too hard,
is smart for them. Because, I mean, China is not planning to go quietly into the ash heap of the Soviet Union if they can help it. What I found most interesting in the news is that Elon Musk is opening a giant battery gigafactory in Shanghai, which doesn't feel like an environment where policies to encourage technological decoupling are necessarily taking hold.
Well, Bruce, what? How do you see this? I mean, at some point, whether it's 5 years or 50 years from now, we reach some sort of detente, some sort of level of mutual comfort between the U.S. and China, because China's not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, economically, in the world of the Cold War, was almost a non-entity. They were not really a trading partner. They could be ignored. China can't be ignored. I mean, if, you know, 20% of their billion plus population is middle class, these are enormous markets that American companies want access to. But where does it all settle out between the U.S. and China where we were able to live in the same world together?
Well, look, let's hope we get to the point where it is a finding a way to coexist. Partly, as of today, I'd say we need President Xi, who is over 80 and a smoker and with a stressful job. We need him to be off the scene. And we need him to be replaced by a Gorbachev-type figure and not by a worse autocrat. You know, it seems to me hard to get anywhere as long as Xi is president for life. He's a dangerous guy. You know, I just finished a book by Hal Brands, and a really interesting observation was your geopolitical foes aren't most dangerous when they're rising with a bright future. It's when they perceive the future as being worse than the present that they're more likely to strike. And that was true of pre-World War I Germany. That was true of Japan in 1941. If you take a look at China's demographic future, it's a disaster because the one-child policy was terrible. When they look geopolitically, they see Japan rearming, and they realize the future is going to be a lot tougher for them to accomplish things than it potentially is in the present right now. You know, they take a look at what they've despoiled their climate. That's not going to get better. They may be as dangerous in the 2020s as they're ever going to be, because we will have retooled our military and otherwise be in a far better position to deal with the Chinese danger by the 2030s. So it's going to take a very careful, cautious hand, and playing the hand very carefully by the United States, by Western allies, to keep calmer heads prevailing.
David, let's close it out. Turn it back around real quick to domestic politics. As you noted at the top of the show, it was the White House Easter egg roll. I may have dinged Governor Hutchinson for announcing his presidential run to Jonathan Carl on the Stephanopoulos show, but President Biden announced his to Al Roker.
So, the president hasn't officially announced. And as we have discussed before, I don't think he needs to. There is no pressure from the left, the center, or the right, or anywhere else in the Democratic Party of somebody running against him.
RFK.
We're not counting that one. that's a sad development. The White House staff is doing what they should be doing, which is they are putting him in a position to have a campaign that's ready to go whenever he wants to announce. I don't think he needs to announce until much later into the fall. Why do it? He can do exactly what he's doing now. He's in Europe this week. Have at it.
I think it's interesting. Republican presidential wannabes are going to all the traditional places, right? Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Pompeo. They're in New Hampshire. They're in Iowa. The only one legitimate Democratic presidential wannabe I can think of is California Governor Gavin Newsom. Where does he go? Florida. To troll Governor DeSantis.
I think he's enjoying himself going down to Florida and doing that. Look, Governor Newsom's a pretty savvy political fellow, and he's waiting in the wings for his opportunity to run at some point. We'll see when that is.
Well, he certainly does have the square jaw. So we shall see. We shall see what else transpires here in 2023, and we will be back on 14th and G to cover all of it in 23 minutes or less, or it's free. Bruce Melman, David Thomas, thanks for joining me on 14th and G.
Sorry for cussing, Dean.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine, or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.